Good singing tonight. I always like this one. Maybe it's the German in it that I like. I don't know, but I like the progression of the message. Yes, the last one's always the good one. You stop to think that through a little bit. Okay, yes, I get this. Let's turn to Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11, and if you picked up your prayer sheet, there are also two other pieces back there to kind of give you a visual aid a little bit. Not so much in the ping pong battle. That's kind of the shorter half sheet. You can see the arrows going back and forth on that. That's touching on that a bit. Got those two sheets there for you, just kind of really by way of information, if you will. On the bigger sheet, as you see at the top, the top part without the box around it is the Seleucid dynasty. As we will get into the kings of the north and kings of the south, the Seleucid dynasty is the kings of the north. That part of, excuse me. The Greek Empire, after Alexander the Great dies, that vast kingdom is split into four pieces. And we've touched on that in previous looks in the book, where we've looked at the various prophecies that spoke of the Grecian Empire. And so now we're going to focus on the kings of the north and kings of the south as they battle back and forth. The Seleucid kingdom was over... And looking at it, kind of the eastern part of the Grecian Empire, Syria and everything east in what was the Grecian Empire. And if you have your map from way back or the booklet that we had showing the map, you can see the extent of the empire and those divisions. The king of the south is primarily Egypt, and that is the Ptolemy. Remember, his kingdom was divided up amongst his four generals. And two of them were not so much concerned about, the ones that took over Greece and what we know as Turkey. That part is kind of out of the picture, prophetically speaking, as we move forward here. And we're looking at those two now, those other two, the Ptolemy dynasty from his general Ptolemy, and from Seleucus, his other general, which will be the king of the north. Ptolemy will be the king of the south. And you see their dynasty, who they married, who was born from them, and you follow that. You can follow that through. You see in both family trees, there's a lot of marrying of brothers and sisters, which I don't find quite fascinating. I find it rather disturbing when you stop to consider these things. But obviously, it was something rather common to take place back then, and we're dealing with. You know, a couple centuries before Christ, as we will note, the Maccabees will come into this. And if you look at apocryphal books, you have 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which are good reading to help us understand this. In about 165 BC, as they rise up in revolt against the Ptolemies, against the Seleucids, and seek to... you know, bring in their own. They are actually revolting against Antiochus Epiphanes, who is a king of the north, who desecrates the temple, puts in an altar to Zeus, offers a pig on it, which now desecrates the temple. The Jews can't use it. And it's that way he seeks to force his religious beliefs on the Jews, and the Maccabees finally rise up in revolt. And push that out, cleanse the temple, restore it to Jewish use. And so that's part of what we have in chapter 11. And it hits this. But, you know, if we want to read about it, yes, we can read about it in Josephus and other places. But the apocryphal books, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, do record that as well and give us a little more insight into that particular battle in those few years when that is taking place. And so it's helpful historically to see some of that. Again, they're not scripture. It's not like the other books that we have in our Bibles before us, but they are books that are, again, helpful to see what's going on. So that's what that's there for, just kind of information. As we go through this chapter, you will see some of these names as we work our way through. This is a hard chapter to try to work our way through, and I'm still kind of battling how I want to do this. Because reading the scriptures and then trying to come back and go through this, then we've kind of lost where was I in the scriptures now that we're back reading my notes. So what I'd like to do is kind of take it a few verses at a time. So we may not get through the whole chapter because it is a longer chapter tonight as we kind of read through, and then I can read my notes so that we can kind of decipher what's being noted here. So we'll start off with the first four verses as Daniel continues to write. He says, "Also I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, even I, stood to confirm and strengthen him." He's just making a statement concerning that. We know that chapters 10, 11, and 12 are one vision. We see that in verse 1 of chapter 10. He's just referring back to an event previously, because Darius the Mede is prior to Cyrus. But he's just mentioning that. But this whole vision of chapters 10, 11, and 12 are in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. So we have the timeline for when this is taking place. And so he notes in verse 2, "And now will I show thee the truth." And this is the angel that's been speaking to him and the like. "Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, shall he stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those." And so as he's giving this vision, depicting what's happening, he notes we're under the Medo-Persian Empire. We note that with Cyrus, with Darius the Mede being mentioned. And he tells them that there are still three kings to come within the realm of Persia. That would be Cambyses, Smerdis, and Darius the First. There will be a fourth one greater than them all, as he notes. That is Xerxes. He's the last of the kings over the Medo-Persian Empire. And as he notes, that last king, in his desires for greatness, Xerxes is moving and wanting to go after Greece. Greece, by this time, and Xerxes is 485 to 465 B.C., and we still have a time yet for Alexander. He's in the 300s. So we still are some time off before Greece is big. But Greece is growing. The city-states are starting to come together. But he eyes them. And he wants more. He's not satisfied with the Medo-Persian Empire where we see it on our map. He wants more. And so he eyes Grecia. And so that's noted. But under Greece, verses 3 through 35, we see this change. In noting this, he says, "And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will." Now, he's not talking in the Medo-Persian Empire. He's talking about that Grecian Empire that he just mentioned, that he's going to stir up all against the realm of Grecia. In Grecia, there's going to rise up a mighty king. That's Alexander the Great. Philip of Macedon, his father, starts to do a lot of the solidifying of the city-states of Greece. Athens was a city-state. Corinth was a city-state. Sparta was a city-state. You know, and just think of it that way, a city-state. A city and the region around it. We might consider it like a county in ours. You know, we would have McPherson city-state, and the surrounding area around McPherson. We are our own everything. We rule ourselves. Nobody rules over us. And so these city-states would battle each other. So Athens would battle Spartica, Sparta, and all these others may battle for power, dominance, for gaining ground. But eventually they start to come together. Philip of Macedon does some of that unifying. But ultimately, Alexander the Great finishes that and then moves eastward. He takes over Asia Minor, moves on into the Middle East, and goes all the way to the Indus River, comes back, takes out Egypt. And so he has this great empire, as it's noted here. And when he's, verse 4, shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven. And so again, this prophecy, because this is in the 500s BC, he's prophesying about something that's still 200 years away, plus, before it ever occurs, and notes that as he rises up, his kingdom, when he's cut off, he's going to die young, Alexander the Great, and his kingdom is going to be divided, but not to his posterity. His children aren't the next king and queen of the Grecian Empire, as we've already noted. His empire is divided amongst his four generals and have nothing to do with his posterity, and not according to his dominion, which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside these. And as if we were to take a look at the Roman Empire and its aftermath, yes, it's divided into these four kings, but even their kingdoms start to shrink because of other influences. We're going to have Rome growing, and Rome is going to be influencing us in this chapter. We're going to touch on that a little bit because they are growing and they're wanting to expand off the Italian peninsula. That Grecian Empire, it was big under Alexander, but then it just starts shrinking because it's divided up amongst the four, and each of them have to try to keep their territory amongst the people around them. And so those things tend to shrink down. And so he's noting this, but now verses 3 through 35, we're looking at these two kings within the Grecian Empire, the kings of the north and the kings of the south. And so he notes that in verse 5, it says, and the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And in the end of years, they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her in these times. We can understand that a little bit. A daughter from a king of the south is given to the king of the north. Let's make alliances. What is he talking about here? We'll come to my notes, and I'd almost rather just read the notes if you want to follow through on the verses to see what the verses say to make heads or tails. I may just go with that. But we see the rise of Alexander, as we noted, the conflicts of the Ptolemies, the kings of the south, and the Seleucids, kings of the north. The king of the south that's noted here is Ptolemy the First, 323 at the end of Alexander the Great until 285 BC. One of his princes is Seleucus the First, or Nicator. After the death of Alexander the Great, the three generals are the ones that take over these places, and Ptolemy takes Syria, which is the north, Ptolemy in the south, Seleucus in the north, and they try to work through amongst themselves those four kings, but we're focusing on these two, south king and north king. Seleucus' kingdom eventually becomes greater than the Ptolemies, for his kingdom reached all the way to the Indus River. Ptolemy the second gives his daughter, Bernice, in marriage to Antiochus the second, who divorced his wife, Laodice, in order to marry, to create this alliance of north and south, as we just saw in verse 6. This alliance will not last. When Ptolemy II dies, Antiochus divorces Bernice, there's a son from this marriage, and remarries Laodice. Now this, I know, it can be confusing. Look at your chart, if you will, a little bit. Look at our verses, but these are the things that are going on with this alliance and brothers and stuff, with what's being said here in our verses. The alliance doesn't last. Again, when Ptolemy dies, Antiochus divorces Bernice, remarries Laodice. Laodice conspires and has Antiochus and Bernice and their son murdered, so that neither shall stand nor his arm, as noted in verse 6. Laodice's son by Antiochus, Seleucus II, succeeds his father to the throne. So again, we see not only the intermarrying, but a lot of conspiracy, rivalry that is going on. The branch of Bernice's roots is Ptolemy III, her brother, and they rule from 284 to 221 BC, and they cover verses 7 through 9. Out of a branch of her roots, that's Bernice's roots, shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them and shall prevail, and shall also carry captives into Egypt, their gods, with their princes and with their precious vessels of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years in the king of the north. And so we see this excursion from the kings of the south going after the kings of the north. And so as we note these roots of Bernice, Seleucus II is occupied in Asia Minor. So Ptolemy III avenges the death of his sister and invades Syria. He kills Laodice and takes a great spoil of wealth back to Egypt. He returns to Egypt triumphant over the kings of the north, as, again, our verses note. But upon Seleucus' second death, his son follows him on the throne in succession. Verse 10 will continue. It says, so the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. But his son shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress, and the king of the south shall be moved with choler and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. Upon Seleucus' death, as I noted, his sons follow him on the throne in succession. Seleucus III is first on the throne. He joins his brother Antiochus III to raise an army to fight with the king of Pergamum to regain territory. Seleucus III is assassinated by two of his officers. So his brother Antiochus III assumes the throne and battles with Egypt in the Orontes River, which is near Damascus, and again in Gaza, but is driven back in defeat to his fortress. Verses 11 and 12 expand upon verse 13 as it moves out and notes what's going on. King of the north, Ptolemy IV, through intrigue, makes Antiochus III believe he has a great army, thus delaying his venture to the south, trying to give him time to raise a larger army. Eventually, the armies meet near Gaza, or Gaza. At first, the northern army is victorious, but then the southern army gains the victory, killing some 10,000 and taking another 4,000 captive. And though Egypt won the battle, or the king of the south, the battle was costly financially, so he's not strengthened by the victory. Ptolemy IV will eventually die in 204, leaving his kingdom to his four-year-old son, Ptolemy V. So let's kind of pick up these verses here. It says, and when he had taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, verse 12, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. For the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. And so again, they note some of the intrigue within these empires, if you will, these kingships that are causing their own problems and strengthening and weakening themselves. Again, the kings of the south win, but it's a what we would call a pyrrhic victory. It cost them a lot in order to victor, so they really weren't strengthened by overcoming the king of the north. Verses 14 through 20 depict the decline of the king of the south and the rise of the king of the north. And the king of the south kind of is weakened. He's not able to be going into Israel particularly and battling with the king of the north, but the king of the north is now strengthened. With Ptolemy IV being a child, Egypt is weakened by internal power struggles between Egyptian ministers and Ptolemy III's wife. Antiochus III, king of the north, joins with Philip V of Macedon to go against Egypt to partition it between them. There are also uprisings within Egypt, the robbers of thy people, as we noted in verse 14. Antiochus III defeats Scopas, the Egyptian general in Sidon, and takes over the glorious land, which is the land of Egypt, in verse 16. And as we've noted in the past, this battle of the kings of the north and kings of the south is going to be taking place in Israel primarily. Because it's between the two. When we think of the kings of the north, we can think of Syria and all the land to the west. Syria is north of Israel. The kings of the south are primarily Egypt, which is south of Israel. The meeting point, Israel. That's the land, that's the battlefield as these two armies battle back and forth trying to get predominance over the other. And so they're going back and forth over Israel. And at times they're going to eye Israel, particularly the kings of the north, as we will see, and want to do things there, as we will see with Antiochus Epiphanes in desecrating the temple and those things. But we have this ping pong battle, as I said, going back and forth between these two. So we continue as Antiochus joins with Philip of Macedon, takes over the glorious land. Antiochus III eased his rule over Israel, thus making them favorable to his rule over them rather than the kings of the south, because the kings of the south had been harsh to the Israelites. Antiochus III said, hey, let's make it a little easier for the Jews here. And so they tend to like that as we read our verses here. He shall also, verse 17, he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither before him. After this shall he turn his face to the isles and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Then shall he stand up in his estate, a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom, but within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. So we'll continue with our notes. Antiochus, in his efforts to control Egypt, gives his daughter Cleopatra, not the famous one that we know from Roman history, as you see many Cleopatras in your notes. Cleopatra's way down the list here. We've got to get down to, you know, about 60 BC for that Cleopatra that, you know, knows Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. This is an ancestor, if you will, to her. Cleopatra obviously was a very well-known family name to pass down and use. But he gives Cleopatra his daughter to be the wife of Ptolemy V, thinking by her presence he could gain control, but this fails as she remains faithful to her new country. That's verse 17. It doesn't work out. He wants her there to be a help, but she doesn't help him. She ends up liking Syria better than liking Egypt. Antiochus now turns his attention toward the Aegean Sea, those isles, and is successful for a time. And at Thermopylae in Greece, in 191 BC, Rome defeats Antiochus and he flees back to Asia Minor. Shortly after, Rome again defeats Antiochus at Magnesia, and Scipio led the Roman army to victory. This ended the reproach or scorn of Antiochus to cease towards Rome. After his defeat by Rome, Antiochus focuses his attention to home, that is, return his face to the fort of his own land, as we see in verse 19, raising taxes to pay tribute to Rome and rebuild his army. In 187 BC, he attacks a temple of Bel in Persia and is killed in the battle. He shall stumble and fall and not be found. So verse 19 shows the demise of Antiochus III. And so on the death of Antiochus III, his son, Seleucus IV, rules as king and increases the taxes upon the people to pay the tribute to Rome. Because again, Rome is growing. Rome is flexing its muscles. They have fought against the king of the north. They've lost. And so Rome says, come on, pay us tribute. And so we have that going on. So Seleucus sends tax collectors throughout the land to gather the tax, to pay that 1,000 talents that they owe Rome each year. And so Heliodorus, the tax collector, the one that is doing this, went into Israel, the glory of the kingdom, and sought to confiscate the treasure of the temple, but he fails. And again, this is noted in 2 Maccabees. Seleucus IV rules rather briefly, but within a few days, reigning only 12 years, his death is mysterious, as we see in verse 20. His death is mysterious. It was not in battle, nor in armed rebellion. One tradition states that Heliodorus poisoned him, seeking the throne for himself. So as we end this, that his days shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. He is gone, but we really don't know how. And the historians don't. Maybe Heliodorus did it by poisoning. We don't know. And so, again, this is prophetic in David's day. We're looking back and say, it's a little suspicious how he died. Now we come kind of to a lengthy spot as we look at just one king of the north, Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes. He's a picture of the Antichrist. And we see that here because Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, is the one who sets up in the temple the altar to Zeus and offers the pig, desecrating the temple, causing problems, and pictures the little horn of Daniel chapter 8 looking towards the Antichrist, who will himself desecrate the temple in his day when he comes to Israel and says what? I'm God. I'm your Messiah. And you are to worship me in God's temple. That is a desecration because he's not God. And so Antiochus's work is a foretaste, a foretype, if you will, of that eventual desecration when he sets up his altar to Zeus and, you know, slaughters a pig in there in an offering to the god Zeus, which desecrates the Greek, the Roman, the Jewish temple. There we go. These are those there. So we focus now on Antiochus Epiphanes in verses 21 through 35, and he has a lengthy spot here as he notes this, but he is the little horn of Daniel chapter 8, which we've already noted. He's not the rightful heir to the throne. And you can see Antiochus there in your top portion and see where he's at, Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. He's not the rightful heir. He's the son of Antiochus the Great, but Antiochus IV had been a hostage of Rome. Again, in those battles that his father had with Rome, They take his son, take him hostage. But Antiochus is trained in Rome. He's a hostage, yes, but he's trained there. And Seleucus the IV takes his son, Demetrius, and swaps. Kind of a hostage swap, if you will. Can we have Antiochus the IV, and in his place, I'll give you my son, Demetrius? And Rome says, sure, okay, fine. We'll have this, not really a prisoner swap, because obviously Demetrius is not a prisoner in his own father's home, but the swap is made. And so that happens. So Seleucus does this. Antiochus comes back, and he sees his power through deception in verses 21 and 22, because Seleucus, his brother, is king of the north. But now that Antiochus Epiphanes is back, he becomes king of the north. And in his state shall stand up a vile person, whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. That's Antiochus the IV. He takes over, gets Seleucus out of the way. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with a small people. And he shall enter peaceably, even among the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, nor his fathers' fathers. He shall scatter among them the prey and spoil and riches, yea, and he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. And so he retains power by redistributing wealth to his followers. He fights against Egypt, the kings of the south, in verses 25 through 27. And as he fights Egypt, he attacks Jerusalem in verse 28 on his way back home. In verses 29 through 30, he again attacks Egypt, but Rome comes to help Egypt, or the kings of the south. 29 and 30, it says, "At the time appointed, he shall return," that is Antiochus, "and come toward the south, but it shall not be as the former or as the latter, for the ships of Chittim shall come against him." That's referring to Rome. "Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant. So shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the Holy Covenant." He comes back to Jerusalem to attack it again on his way home after his failure against Egypt, the king of the south. And he does intrigue with the apostate Jewish people, those that forsake the Holy Covenant. And there were Jews at the time that did. They were Jew by blood, but they weren't Jew by religion. And so they partner with Antiochus to cause issues and problems, and he's able to then desecrate the temple, verses 31 and 32. "And the arms shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice, and they shall place the abomination that maketh desolate. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries." Again, he's able to do this because he's gotten in partnership with Jews that have nothing to do with the Jewish religion. And he's able to come in, put in this altar to Zeus, desecrate the temple, make it desolate, because of these Jews that were willing to work with him. I'm sure they were getting money. Hey, yeah, we'll work with you against our own people because it's lucrative for us. And so they sell out their own people. And but the people, verse 33 as we continue, "but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits." That refers to the Maccabees and Mattathias' sons, his five sons, who will then rise up against Antiochus Epiphanes and fight. Mattathias is a priest who refuses the false worship that Antiochus wants, flees to the mountains with his five sons, and his five sons continue the revolt. His son Judas, known for refurbishing the temple in 164, B.C. He's known as Judas Maccabeus, or the hammerer. That's what Maccabeus means, the hammerer. Judas is the one that pushes Antiochus out of the temple. They're able to restore it, cleanse the temple, restore it to Jewish use, and pushes Antiochus the IV out of Jerusalem for the time, and move on with that. So verse 34, "Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries, and some of them of understanding shall fall to try them and to purge and to make them white, even to the time of the end, because it is yet for a time appointed." Just noting this getting rid of Antiochus, getting him out of Jerusalem proper, cleansing the temple, restoring the Jewish worship as it had been, and removing him from that. But again, this is picturing Antichrist as well, which is what the last part of our chapter then moves to. If we were looking at it through a telescope, let's say, we see the first mound of Antiochus Epiphanes, but beyond him, and because he pictures it, we see the Antichrist. And we move down even further in prophetic time from the 160s to the end times, to when the Antichrist comes. And so we see in verse 36, "And the king shall do according to his will, and he shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that that is determined shall be done." And so we immediately, just in, if we were to read all of this, we would see a change, because that's not Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes didn't exalt himself above every god and shall speak marvelous things against the god. I mean, he does speak marvelous things against the god of God, because he puts the god of Zeus in there. But we're looking now at a different scenario. Even though, again, Antiochus Epiphanes pictures him, a type of it. But he's not the Antichrist, he just pictures it. And so now we move to that picture of the Antichrist and what he will do in the end times. We see the establishment of false worship under him, as we can note here, and continuing in verse 36, "against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished, for that that is determined shall be done. Neither shall he regard the God of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any god, for he shall magnify himself above all." Again, that's not Antiochus the IV. This is the Antichrist. "But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory. And he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him, like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." It's interesting. There is a battle in Israel with the south and the north by Antichrist. So again, we see this change here, because he notes king of the south and king of the north. Well, Antiochus is a king of the north in our previous readings, because he's part of the Seleucid dynasty. But now we've moved on to this new person, this Antichrist, and the end days. And so while he has come to Jerusalem, he's come there, these are going to come to battle against him. And we see that in the book of Revelation as well. Tidings of war from the east and the north in verses 44 through 45, but let's continue. It says, "He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. And he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries. The land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and cover all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore shall he go forth with a great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come in his end, and none shall help him. Again, we see the Antichrist coming to Jerusalem, coming to Israel, setting himself up. And again, when we get to the book of Revelation, we'll see this. It's depicted for us there, still prophetically, for John to be writing about it. But he's noting this, that as the Antichrist sets him up as God, all things are not hunky-dory in the world. Just because there's a one-world government of the revived Roman Empire and he wants to set himself up over all the world, there are places that say, I don't think so. And so we have Revelation chapter 9, verses 13 through 21, talking about the Euphrates River being dried up and these millions coming from the east to go against the Antichrist. That may very well be what he's talking about here, as that depicts that coming during the reign of Antichrist in that seven-year tribulation. So, I know, it's a ping-pong match going back and forth. It can be confusing to follow this going back and forth with these kings and who that is. Looking at those, looking at that half sheet, again, may help. Take time to read through the chapter, a time or two, or three or four, if you want to try to get this to kind of sink in. But because of this going back and forth, the intrigues that are there, the marrying for trying to get alliances between these two, and that faltering, and Israel caught in the middle, and then again this picture of, yes, Antiochus Epiphanes, but then out of that grows this greater image of the Antichrist that's coming during that last of the 70 weeks of Daniel, that is the ultimate picture that he closes with in this chapter to look at because of what he does. Antiochus Epiphanes was child's play with what he did compared to what the real Antichrist will do. I mean, it was bad enough that Antiochus, you know, desecrates the temple. What the Antichrist will do is far worse because he is setting himself up as God. And so there's that connection, if you will, that foreshadowing that is talked about here. But again, this power struggle between these two kingdoms that are left out of the Grecian Empire is what this chapter is all about, with Israel caught in the middle between those two as they have this power struggle for prestige over one another, gaining the other and not being able to. So that's what he touches on. We come to chapter 12, Lord willing, next week, the conclusion of Gentile domination of Israel. And we'll see that final message and what he closes with on a little better note as we close out the book of Daniel. But again, it takes some time to read this chapter kind of over and over again to get the flow of the back and forth between them. The lines may help with understanding who is doing what, who they're married to, the interconnections. But I think the half sheet can help a little bit more because I think it does note some of the verses from this chapter as you work your way through that. So.